Welcome to the podcast edition of American Warrior Radio with Ben Bueller Garcia, presented by Medicare Mentors. American Warrior Radio, telling the stories of the American men and women who protect us at home and abroad. And now, here is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia.
We all owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. One thing I've learned in my more than half a century on this globe is that there is evil in the world. Whether it's gassing millions of persons in concentration camps or beheading a single person for a propaganda video, one of my concerns with our modern-day nation is that there's a certain level of naivety or perhaps an unwillingness to face the reality that evil exists. Two of our guests today, I think, would agree with me. They've confronted evil in one of its purest forms. They've been designated, not our guests, but this group has been designated a terrorist organization by the United Nations and many other nations around the world. They first appeared in 1999 as the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. In 2014, they declared themselves a worldwide caliphate, claiming religious, political, and military authority over Muslims worldwide. At the height of their power, they controlled large swaths of territory, including one-third of Iraq and Syria, an area about the size of today's Great Britain. It is believed that they are operational in over 18 countries, and at one time, 9 million persons were subject to their version of Sharia law. Ethnic cleansing and brutalities like videotape beheadings and mass executions were their trademarks. Convert or die. Thanks to an, let's just say, unusual coalition of the willing and sometimes not so willing, much of their territorial gains have been reversed, but they are still a threat. Our two guests today were on the front lines of the battle against ISIS, and they detail their experiences in a new book titled Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Sale. Combined, they have over 50 years of service in the United States Army and Air Force. Dana Pittard retired from the Army at the rank of Major General and was chosen to lead the initial U.S. response to halt the aggressive spread of ISIS in Iraq. Wes Bryant retired as a Master Sergeant in the U.S. Air Force. As a Joint Terminal Attack Controller, Wes was the tactical lead for a contingent of special forces to first step foot in Iraq to stop ISIS. Gentlemen, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Well, thank you, Ben. It's good to be on.
Thanks
so much for having us. This is Wes as well.
Of course, both of you are familiar with protocols, so let's get that out of the way right off the bat. General, may I call you Dana?
Absolutely.
Okay, Wes.
Dana, Ben.
Okay, Wes, I know you've always been jealous about pilots having call signs. Do you want me just to call you Vampire, or should we stick with Wes?
I like Vampire.
Okay, we'll go with that. Now, General, let's start off with you have... not only from being there, but you're quite the expert in the Middle East. Let's begin with you. Everyone has heard about ISIS, but I don't know if we really know who or what or why they are. Can you enlighten us a little bit just to frame the discussion?
Well, sure. You know, ISIS stands for Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. It's been called many things, ISIL, ISIL. It's called Daesh. It started with the roots Al-Qaeda in Iraq is where it originally started, the remnants of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. After Al-Qaeda Iraq was defeated from the surge at the end of 2009 time period. After U.S. forces left Iraq in 2011, they reconstituted a little bit and then reconstituted more and more in Syria after that time. And so by 2014, being a part of Bashar al-Assad's anti-Syrian government movement, they'd become a powerful force. In fact, they were very disciplined fighters. They were brutal. And you talked about evil. I would say evil also. And then in June of 2014, they were strong enough to be able to invade northern Iraq and take Iraq's second largest city, Mosul, about 1 million people.
Definitely a threat. Now, Wes, a key part of this entire book and yours and the story that is related in this book is the role of a joint terminal air controller. Explain to us in civilian terms, Wes, what that job is. I think it's one of the lesser known roles in the Air Force. And then also, how is the strike cell concept different from what had been traditionally up to that point, your embedded role very often with special operations forces?
Yeah, you know, there's been, you know, you can see in movie and TV depictions of what my job would be. Normally, in the past, it was called a forward air controller, a FAC, stemmed out of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. Eventually, the Department of Defense decided to, you know, designate it joint terminal attack controller because we work joint across the services. But simply put, it's guys on the ground with ground maneuver units, be it infantry, armor, special forces, SEALs, calling in airstrikes, directing calling in airstrikes. That's the terminal end of our job. We also do overall air power advisement. We integrate air power into a ground commander scheme of maneuver, and that's actually about 90% of the job. And really 10% of it is putting those bombs on target or that ordnance on target. And the difference in with strike cell operations is that normally as a JTAC, we're out forward on the battlefield, usually with eyes on, but at least somewhere in proximity to our targets with those ground forces that are engaging with the targets. And sometimes, you know, we're actually engaging with the targets ourselves with small arms while calling in airstrikes. So with a strike cell, we are remote. We're remotely controlling, if you will, from an operations center, somewhere in the rear, not right on the battlefield. And we are coordinating with forward ground forces. In the case of ISIS, initially we were coordinating with Iraqi and Kurdish forces on the ground in Iraq. And then we extended that into Syria and even operations in Afghanistan against ISIS over the following couple of years. So it became a lot more complicated and sometimes a lot more difficult. I mean, there's things more difficult about being on the ground. If you're taking fire yourself and calling in airstrikes, that adds an element of difficulty. But there's other things, other times sitting in the strike cell when you actually wish that was the case. Man, yeah. If I could just be on the ground taking fire from these guys, it's a lot more simple.
Yeah, Wes, I get that. I get that sense of you that you'd rather be out there in the field when you're doing this. Now, speaking of difficult, Dana, this, you don't just sort of write your memoirs of what was pretty much a very secretive operation up to this point in time and just go to publish. How difficult was it? I just completed reading the preview release of your book. How difficult was it to get this thing through all the channels? I assume the Pentagon and others had to sign off on this, correct?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it was a story that it wasn't very well known at all because it wasn't, you know, we didn't have embedded press that kind of wasn't allowed for this operation. That's why the book itself is a very compelling story. But we wanted to make sure, though, that we didn't give away any secrets. So we had the Pentagon screen it. And, of course, that's mandatory. And normally it takes 60 to 90 days. But it took a little over 15 months to have it totally screened by the Pentagon and CIA. They combed through it very carefully. We went back and forth on different things. But the book really is on the edge. And I think it'll be very enlightening to the American people of how we operate, and in fact, how really a small group of Americans is about no bigger footprint than about 1,500 troops was able to, along with obviously the Iraqi security forces and Kurdish Peshmerga, was able to stop what seemed like this unstoppable juggernaut of ISIS, but put them on the defensive by the end of 2014.
Well, I tell you what, sir, I'm a big believer in the power of storytelling. That's why I do this radio show. I've had the author of 12 Strong on the program before, and I really, you know, when I read your, gentlemen, both of you, when I read your book, I see potential for something like that here, hopefully down the line. I'm sure that wouldn't break either of your hearts.
Well, we're getting such a really great response from so many people about the book. And so many people wanted us to tell the story. And I think it would be a very compelling story, whether it's a movie, TV, whatever. But it was just great. It's a great story.
Gentlemen, stick around. When we come back, I want to begin with what I learned from your book, a couple of things that really sets ISIS apart. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined live by General Dana Pittard and Master Sergeant Wes Bryant. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by retired Major General Dana Pittard, United States Army, and retired Master Sergeant Wes Bryant, United States Air Force. Now, you normally wouldn't think that those two types of folks have something in common, but these two gentlemen do, one of which is their new book coming out very soon called Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell. Wes, let's start off with you. One thing that, in reading the book, and then there was actually a quote that you had in the book that really, I shouldn't say made me chuckle, but put me on the next topic was the quote that amongst you and your comrades in the strike cell, you said, if they move tactically sound, they're probably ISIS. What is it about, yeah. I mean, and that's sort of a clue to something that set these guys apart from what we've traditionally dealt with when I use the quotation finger insurgents.
Yeah, that's what set them apart. Strangely, you could say sadly enough, in the initial months and really that first year when we were starting this campaign against ISIS and trying to help the Iraqis beat them back, the Iraqi military, as we know, was just in a bad state. And not only had a lot of their units been pushed back by ISIS, that's how they were able to gain so much territory in the north, but they just were not as skilled. Now, why that is, it's kind of lost on me because we spent a long time training them. But keep in mind, all the fighters of ISIS, many of them had been trained by American forces at one point or another, as long as we had been there. So you had American military training, in some cases soft training, given to these forces, who, or at least parts of them, who at some point decided after we left, okay, I'm going over to this new group called ISIS, and now they're infusing all of that training into the ISIS military, into their militias. And I think part of it was they were just much more motivated in their cause than the Iraqi military and even government was at the time. Motivation with a little bit of training can make you seem a lot more tactically sound than your counterparts.
Thank you, Wes. Dana, it wasn't just their military training that set them apart, but they have shown a certain sophistication even in their recruiting and their use of propaganda in the Muslim world. Was that pretty apparent to you right off the bat when you first took charge of this assignment?
It was. In fact, absolutely. Initially, the ISIS was getting out 90,000 tweets a day. They were using social media. They were using the Internet. They were using all sorts of different means as far as recruiting. And they were recruiting not just in the Middle East, but the West and Europe and even the United States, as we know. But one other thing that set ISIS apart from the Iraqis was their leadership. They would even have senior leaders come to the battlefield to help rally their fighters. We watched that pattern, and then we took advantage of it. We turned each of the engagements between the Iraqis and ISIS that we were involved with into these really huge leadership ambushes. We took advantage of the fact that their top leaders would come to the battlefield. That's why 40 out of 50 of their top leaders were killed within the first 8 months.
And I tell you, I enjoyed that part of the strategy as reflected in the book. Wes, Ben gets a dumb question, at least one dumb question per show. So let's get this out of the way right off the bat, because you've been out there in the field. When I see gun camera footage or things, I see these. Sometimes it almost like the targets at the last minute are trying to get out of the blast zone. So my dumb question of the day is, as far as incoming, artillery mortars versus guided bombs and missiles, I mean, can these guys actually hear it coming, or by that time is it too late?
Yes, they absolutely they can. So any artillery pieces, obviously you can hear those even when they go off, regardless of how far away they are. You don't know if they're necessarily coming towards you, but if you're in a big fight, you can probably make an assumption. Now, bombs, you can hear it coming a few seconds out, missiles as well. And so, you know, I can't go into detail on how we would do things, but we have methods by which we can reduce that sound signature prior to impact so that we prevent what we call squirters, which is individuals running after impact, surviving from an impact. It's surprising how many of our enemy have survived. I've watched 500-pound bombs be dropped. Control them to be dropped right in the center of a enemy formation and watch a bunch of guys just run off from it. So it's pretty crazy. And we described that in the book fairly in depth at a couple of different points.
Okay. They must have had their Wheaties. I'll have to keep that in mind. Gentlemen, one thing, a common theme I see throughout the book, both in the strike cell, in the field, back in the political halls, is a certain sense of frustration with the rules of engagement, and eventually you progress to making that a little bit more workable. But Dana, one thing that just really struck me was an observation you relate in the book. Tell us about what you and your comrades observed via a Predator drone feed on August 3rd. I can imagine as a warrior, that was a perfect example of how this could have been really gut-wrenching for you in the early days of this campaign.
It really was. Most of us had been veterans of fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Predator drone feed, we just happened to be the village of Quneia when ISIS rounded up all the villagers, men, women, and children together, and they separated the children and the women, and then they put them in trucks and sent them off. Now, what we found out later is they sent them off into to be sex slaves, either to also to be forced wives of ISIS fighters. And then the men, they had them dig trenches. And at first, we actually hoped that they were building defensive trenches. But in fact, they were turned out that they were digging their own graves. And we watched as they were then massacred. They were machine gunned down. This was 80 men, villagers. Who are Yazidi. And Yazidi is an ethnic people, religious sect that's in northern Iraq that ISIS was trying to massacre. And the ISIS fighters then kicked their bodies, and threw them in the trenches. It was gut-wrenching watching that and not being able to do anything about that, because that was before we were authorized airstrikes.
And let me just clarify, sir, you had the assets to do something about it, but you were not allowed to pull the trigger, if you will.
Well, actually, the assets were not in the air at the time.
Okay.
The Predator drone could technically have, you know, shot a Hellfire missile to hit some of the ISIS fighters. But at that time, very restricted rules of engagement. We weren't allowed to fire at that time. Now, after that that gut-wrenching massacre occurred, we were then authorized, if that ever happened again, that we could do our best to prevent that.
And there was a progression that one reads throughout the book where luckily the restrictions on you and your warriors were pulled off a little at a time. Wes, we recently had the founder of the original Top Gun, the Navy Top Gun, on the show, and his closing advice at the end of the program, very stridently delivered, was, look, if we're going to send our young men and women off to war, the handcuffs have to come off. You have to let them prosecute the enemy as best they could. You were, I think, one of the professional, most gratifying professional accomplishments in your career was your successful lobbying to get these rules of engagements changed, correct?
Yes, at the beginning of before we even started the airstrike campaign, we had some issues with rules of engagement.
And very often does a master sergeant go in and, you know, kick in a general's door and say, get your mind right, or obviously I'm
yeah, it's not that often. The Iraq crisis, as we called it, was a unique situation. In fact, you know, me and my special operations JTAC working right under General Petard, extremely unique to run strikes against ISIS. But before that, I was actually in Bahrain at what's called the Joint Special Operations Task Force that was leading the force that had set foot in Baghdad. I was there for the first few weeks of the Iraq crisis. Before we even got the chance to start going after ISIS, we were sending our teams out, our special forces teams, with my JTACs attached to go do assessments of the Iraqi military. That was led by General Petard's staff. And then our Green Beret teams went out and did these assessments. Well, the rules of engagement were so strict at that time because the administration just did not want to get into combat operations in Iraq again, understandably, that we had a situation where if our guys were taking fire, they could not call in for close air support unless they called all the way back through their headquarters, which went back to the embassy headquarters where General Petard was, got a hold of General Petard somehow, wherever he was, you know, in all his briefings through the day, and got approval. And so we had our guys going out in the Baghdad area and further outside where ISIS was, because at this time we were taking our guys were taking indirect fire mortars from ISIS onto the airfield. And so they were going out where ISIS could potentially near ambush them, which would be a very high probability because that's how ISIS was operating. And they'd have to sit there, you know, return fire with small arms, ground fire, and their Iraqi forces. That's great. But we had, at that time, some kind of air power overhead, and we were being told, nope, you're not going to be able to use any of it unless that goes all the way through this long chain to General Petard and back down to you. So I was in a unique situation to help change that, and we ended up being able to.
Well, I tell you what, reading the book, you had me, well, both of you had me gritting my teeth and clenching my fists throughout the entire progress of reading your book. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, I want to pursue that topic. And the question for my guests is, lawyers in war, who the hell let them in? Stick around, folks. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're joined by Major General Dana Petard, U.S. Army retired, and Master Sergeant Wes Bryant, United States Air Force retired. We're talking about their new book out soon. You can find it at Amazon, your local bookstore, called Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell. Gentlemen, before the break, I sort of teased about this, and we don't have enough time to get into it. I was expressing my frustration as I read through your book about the idea in modern warfare, at least for the United States, the fact that lawyers have entered into the equation. I just marvel at the fact that you literally had lawyers there on call at your strike cell, you know, on 12-hour shifts who had to sign off on some of these attacks. And I guess in one case, even there was a call in Syria later on where we could have gotten some senior leaders and we didn't. But let's just leave it at that. Wes, you it's interesting the trend I see in the book of your career. Yes, sir.
If I could just briefly on the question of lawyers, because it's an important point. You know, our rules of engagement come from the Secretary of Defense or SecDef. The lawyers are an important part of our operation because we do stand for the rule of law. This emerging, emerging concept and what we're able to do with the strike cell is an immense killing machine. It really is. We have not been able to do that on such a large scale in the past. But we must make sure that what we do is, in fact, legal. And the whole rule of law separates us from enemies like ISIS, who kills wantonly, you know, at any point. The power of the U.S. military is, in fact, immense. So making sure that our strikes are legal are extremely important, and that's what the American people would want us to do. Now, sometimes we had, you know, quick disagreements with our lawyers. I got that. And that's what you saw some of the frustration in the book. But the whole concept of having lawyers at every level is important because, again, the strike cell is an immense killing machine. We want to make sure we're killing the right people.
Fair enough. I stand enlightened. General, I appreciate that. I just, again, easy for me to say I'm sitting in a comfortable studio, not on the front lines, but it really, it frustrates me. Well, thank you for that. We'll leave it at that. Wes, speaking of frustration, you didn't start off as a fan of senior officers, and in fact, you admit to, on occasion, cursing the name of your now co-author, Major General Dana Pittard, but first impressions change that. Right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, early on, really going in with the Crisis Response Force, which is all special operations force, knowing that General Pittard had a small staff at the embassy, and he was the ground force commander in Iraq, so he was overarching in charge of Iraq. But I had other parallel special operations leadership, and, you know, for the first few weeks, we were, all of us were, I would say, we felt like we were being yanked around as far as the mission went. We had no idea day to day what we were going to end up doing and even what we were there to do other than to keep our U.S. personnel safe and to keep Baghdad from being taken by ISIS. So, you know, at my level, it was really easy to blame that first general up the chain. And so that's what I did. And, you know, a few weeks into it in August when we started the Baghdad strike cell right on the Bayap airport near my task force, when I first met General Pittard, because he's the one that initiated it and he was going to be the target engagement authority sitting with us the entire time for all our operations. Then I realized that I was a little bit wrong about some things. And then in the course of writing this book, actually, it was incredibly enlightening for me, because as we were writing, and as I was myself reading Dana's material, I learned so much that at the time I didn't know as that very tactical level warfighter. Even sitting with General Pittard and having him approve all of our strikes, briefing him daily. But, you know, I had one lane, he had the other, and there's things you're just not privy to at that level sometimes.
Well, and speaking of that, Dana, did you know until you saw the first draft of your book that around the strike cell, the word was if the pistachios and the lollipops came out, it was game on?
I didn't realize that, but I know that having those pistachios there just kept me focused. It's I love Turkish pistachios. I don't drink coffee, but I had iced tea there. Just stayed focused because there were hours and on hours. In fact, I remember one time it was like 36 hours on call during a specific operation with the Iraqis. And I physically put myself there because I wanted to ensure that the Iraqis were in fact supported and there were going to be some close calls. But looking the Iraqi commanders in the eye, there was trust. So they trusted that we were going to follow through. I wanted to make sure that we followed through.
Now, sir, it must have been a relief to finally get the authority to fully prosecute how you needed to prosecute things. But then the cat herding began. I mentioned at the beginning of the show, sometimes there's an axiom that the enemy of my friend is my friend of my any others. Anyway, you're trying to put together some groups that have had long, centuries old simmering disputes, and that must have been, well, just from reading the book, that's quite the challenge.
Oh, sure, that was like herding cats, but. But I would go back to something you mentioned as far as once we got permission, the ROE expanded. In some ways, if subtly you can see it in the story in the book, there was reluctance from the administration to allow us. They kept it being restricted. So we pushed the envelope on that. They said, you can only do strategic targets. So we ended up making strategic targets almost the entire map of Iraq so that we could, in fact, do this. So there was surprise, I think, in the administration. We were conducting airstrikes over and over again without their permission. And then finally, it just came down that just continue to do it. So it took leadership. It took really pushing the envelope to be able to do that. And as far as herding cats, yes. Different elements. some of which couldn't stand each other. They said the Peshmerga, the Kurdish Peshmerga, which are the Kurdish fighters, wouldn't fight alongside the Iraqis. We showed that, yes, for a common enemy as brutal as ISIS, we could figure that out. The Shia militias who had Iranian advisors with them, were told stay away from that. But we also needed the Shia militias also in the fight against ISIS. So we're able to, again, figure a workaround on that. We never directly coordinated with the Iranians, but we coordinated through the Iraqi military to the Shia militias to the Iranians. But all for a common purpose, this brutal, evil enemy, ISIS. And that, again, that's why the book is so compelling.
Sir, one thing that also struck me was, because I've had family and I've talked to a lot of warriors that have served in that part of the world, and I know there's a certain, what I've been told is they respect strength, and to some extent they respect the willingness to exert extreme violence when necessary. But there was a kind of a thread I caught throughout the book that kept coming back to, well, we've trained you, you've got the tools, but do you have the will to fight? And I just want to read one quote from the book that really struck me. You're addressing 30 Iraqi generals, trying to convince them to relieve Baiji, I guess it's called. And you stand up in impromptu speech, and you say, the relief of the siege of Baiji could be Iraq's finest hour of 2014, but you must have the will to fight and win and take your country back from ISIS. I personally say shame on you if you cannot step up and fight for Iraq and our brave Iraqi shoulders holding on for dear life in Baiji. Shame on anyone who shirks the fight for freedom, because together I know we can crush ISIS once and for all. Those are some pretty bold words to 30 other generals, sir.
They were. And some of the generals I had known for years from previous tours in Iraq, and some I did not know. But the bottom line is, we knew that they had the strength, the military strength, but they needed to have the will to fight. They had been humiliated in early June of 2014 when the equivalent of 5 Iraqi divisions were destroyed by ISIS. So in some ways, we helped them get their groove back on. But in talking to them, yes, I was in some ways shaming them to make sure that they could relieve their own soldiers that were holding on for dear life.
Sir, one thing that came out in the book was something we don't hear very much about, and definitely a group that had the will and the means and the desire, some of our Iraqi pilots, and just the story of some of the things they did in those attacks is pretty amazing.
It really is. In fact, it was my old friend, General Hassan Pallah, who had been my culture advisor back in 2006 and 2007. He rolled the tape forward to 2014. He is now the vice chief of the Iraqi Air Force. And when ISIS threatened to take a certain area of Iraq where the F-16 training was taking place, that had to be moved to the United States. So Iraq didn't have an air force, really, for fighter bombers. So they bought aircraft from Iran, the old Su-25s, 24s, with 1970s, 1980s technology, and they also bought them from Russia. But they had to find pilots. So they found former pilots from pre-Desert Storm, and there were like 11 of them. They were all older than 45 years old, 45 to 60 years old. But General Fallah trained them. He got in the pilot seat himself, and they did some heroic things until, you know, late in 2015 when the F-16 train that took place in the United States, and those Iraqi pilots were able to join the fight.
Well, and I think we did that training right here in my own hometown of Tucson. I might be mistaken, but that's not that important. Wes, when we come back, I want to talk about something else I learned from the book. You know, a lot of us civilians, we see the videos, we see the, you know, we play the video games, and it all seems very easy. But I want to talk with you about the fact that despite all this technology, why instinct still plays a key role. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Stick around. We'll be right back with General Dana Pittard and Master Sergeant Wes Brandt talking about Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking with the two authors of a new book coming out called Hunting the Caliphate. Both Major General Dana Pittard and Master Sergeant Wes Bryant were on the front lines of what I believe is a successful initiative to eliminate a lot of the threat to at least that part of the world in the name that goes by the name of ISIS. Wes, one thing that really struck me in the book was we've got all this high-tech equipment. It's snazzy, it's jazzy. It can, you know, you can read the license plates from I don't know how far up. But there was two examples in the book where it became very apparent that there's, and I'll tell you, I personally am a person who always wants to see a pilot in an aircraft. I just think having that human gear in the machine is really important. And there's two examples in the book that really struck me. One was in the chapter called ISIS on a Silver Platter, where you were tracking some vehicles, and I think somebody wanted to pull the feed off those vehicles, but the decision was made to stick with them, and that turned out to be quite the intriguing target. Tell us about those 70 folks crossing the border.
That was one of Dana's chapters. He goes in depth on a strike that they actually prosecuted from the embassy strike cell, what we call the embassy strike cell in the book, before we started our special operations strike cell, where they were watching outer regions and of an objective area, and saw a large group of about between 50 and 70 individuals massed together. And that initially is what we sometimes, you know, we refer to that as just a big red flag and not the same terms. But obviously we can't just drop bombs on a target like that. But it's very suspicious. Well, there were limited assets in theater at the time. So other individuals in that operations center were saying, hey, let's shift priority. This is just a group of whoever, probably refugees, civilian people fleeing, whatever. We had no idea who it was. And so General Pittard's call was, no, let's keep it on this. Well, fast forward a few minutes, about 30 minutes, an hour, we realized that we can see suicide vests being handed out via trucks from another convoy that met up with this group of what ended up being ISIS fighters. These were going to be, this was going to be a large mass of suicide attacks against Iraqi forces' front lines. And so once that was realized, the direction they were heading, the fact that they were masking their movement through terrain, the fact that we could identify actual suicide vests being put on them, and that they were going right towards Iraqi front lines, you know, then the gloves were off. In that instance, actually, we had one of our Navy SEAL JTACs. He's a brand new JTAC qualified SEAL lieutenant. Not a new SEAL, but newly JTAC qualified right before he had deployed. And so his first control in a combat theater, you know, they essentially mopped up all of those suicide fighters. It was about a kill of about 58 confirmed. And these guys would have, you know, it sounds bloodthirsty, but hey, we get bloodthirsty when we're going out after an enemy like this. They would have caused immense damage on the Iraqi front lines and probably broken through, enabled ISIS to damage a significant part of the Iraqi objective areas.
Yeah, they would have wreaked havoc. I promise I would, so I'm going to mention it. Here we go. In the chapter, Vampire Village. We talked earlier in the discussion about how one of the unique things about ISIS was they're no dummies. They started to adapt their tactics and their movements to cloak themselves and hide themselves from your observation drones and from attacks. And there was one chapter and also another example of a very brave Iraqi commander who basically jumped in his tank and took a few Humvees out and decided to take it to some ISIS fighters who were really causing problems. And I, you know, Wes, it just made me smile because the fighters were hiding themselves from our observation technology. And the answer you came up with was you just told the Iraqi commander, point the barrel of your tank at where the bad guys are, and that's where we'll attack.
Yeah, it was a severely outnumbered Iraqi force of about no more than 30 with one tank, the commander commanding the commander of this unit commanding the tank. I think 2 to 3 gun trucks and then dismounted Iraqi forces against upwards of 60 and higher ISIS forces, all embedded in multi-story buildings. But when the Iraqi forces conducted this counteroffensive, as they we're watching them, of course, we're watching the our friendly forces maneuver with 2 different drones. As we're watching, they're calling up buildings and saying, "We are taking fire from this building." So by the time, with that chain of communications, by the time we're able to shift our drone sensor over to that building to see if we can verify gunfire, which is what we need to vet that target, because we cannot just drop on a building with Iraqi forces telling us there's ISIS in there. We have to see something to confirm it or have some more intelligence to confirm it other than one source. Well, by the time we shifted that sensor over, we saw nothing. And most often ISIS was not only setting their muzzles back from openings, but they would at the most fire a few rounds and then retreat back into the opening of the building, be it a window or a doorway. So we just could not see the gunfire to verify because that chain of communication was just too slow by the time we got the information up through to our strike cell, translated through an Iraqi operations center to us, right? So actually a SEAL in our strike cell, a SEAL that was liaisoning with those 4 Iraqi operations centers said, "Hey, just get this guy to point the tank barrel, and then we'll shift our sensor wherever he points." And it was simple, but it's something that sometimes when you're involved in it, you're like, "Oh, why didn't we think of that?"
Yeah,
you know. So this is a team effort. So that's what we did. And as soon as he started doing that, he'd point that barrel. Boom! I told our drone controllers sitting in Nevada, controlling their drone for us overhead this objective area, and this was Karma, Iraq. I said, as soon as you see that tank barrel shift that drone over, and that's what they did. So it was seconds, and we were able to see gunfire, pinpoint gunfire in almost every case. And as soon as we had that, we had a vetted target and could start dropping bombs on, these were embedded fighting positions, sniper positions, machine gun positions that were just otherwise would have wreaked havoc on this maneuvering, this small maneuvering ISIS force or Iraqi force.
Gentlemen, I don't want to give too much away. I want folks to buy the book, Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell. I tell you, we get into Syria and things get even more. There's even more cats to herd. That's a little, I'll just leave it at that. Let's wrap up. General, if you don't mind, Dana, what you say the hunt is not over. It's constantly evolving, and we had better evolve with that. And about the 2 minutes we have left, sir, can you tell us what you mean by that, and what do we as a nation need to do to continue to counter this ISIS threat, wherever it may be?
Sure. In fact, we were able to defeat the geographical ISIS caliphate, which was this ISIS nation state they'd set up geographically. We were able to defeat that on the ground. But ISIS as a terrorist organization has not been totally beaten yet. ISIS will appear in different ungoverned areas and failed states around the world, like in Libya, like in Somalia, like in Afghanistan, and still in Syria could pop up, back up, even in Iraq, if we're not careful. So we've got to keep our foot on ISIS's throat until they're absolutely extinguished. And that's what this book is about. It's an exciting book. It's suspenseful. I've been told it reads like a Tom Clancy novel, going back and forth, except it's true. So as we move out in the future, we've got to keep our focus on defeating ISIS and extremism wherever it is in the world, whether out in the world or even domestically in the future.
Excellent, excellent, sir. Wes, real quick, you—I know you went on to Afghanistan. Is this sort of like a whack-a-mole situation for you?
Definitely was like a whack-a-mole. I went from 2014, helping start the campaign against ISIS in Iraq, 2015, starting some of the first strikes in northwest Syria against ISIS, and then 2017 went back to Afghanistan after about 4 years having been there, and now ISIS had emerged in Afghanistan, and that was half of our fight. We were fighting a reemerged Taliban that was stronger, along with what we called ISIS-K, and that's still going on today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tell you, General, I really enjoyed the book. I encourage folks to go out and buy it, Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell. Major General Dana Pittard and Master Sergeant Wes, call sign Vampire Bryant, thanks for sharing your time with us here on American Warrior Radio. We'd like to have you back again sometime, maybe when it becomes a movie.
Sounds good, Ben. Thank you for having us.
All right, gentlemen, take care. You can find this podcast and over 200 others, ladies and gentlemen, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Follow us on Facebook, American Warrior Radio, and Twitter, Warrior Radio TUC. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.
You've been listening to the podcast edition of American Warrior Radio with Ben Bueller Garcia, presented by Medicare Mentors. American Warrior Radio, telling the stories of the American men and women who protect us at home and abroad. American Warrior Radio airs Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KRDO News Radio 105.5 FM, 1240 a.m. and 92.5 FM, and is available by podcast at KRDO.com. Select the radio tab and click on podcasts.